Please, O Lord our God, make the words of your Torah sweet in our mouths. Please, O Lord our God, make the words of your Torah sweet in our mouths, in the mouths of your people, in the mouths of the house of Israel, in the mouths of your people, in the mouths of the house of Israel.
Well, Shabbat Shalom, everybody. Good to see everyone today, and happy calendar new year, I guess we should say. Hope you guys all had a nice time, maybe a break. It's good. Today feels like a nice, quiet, restful Shabbat, doesn't it? A little rainy, good for a Shabbat nap in the afternoon. I want to begin today, kind of to kick off 2020 with something a little bit different. I'm going to begin a sermon series teaching through the book of Hebrews. We're going to begin teaching through the book of Hebrews. And this is a huge undertaking. Let me just to kind of get a sense, how many of you have read the book of Hebrews? Okay, most of you have read it. 13 chapters, very dense. You read a lot of it and you're like, what is going on here? And there's a lot to it. But I feel that it's an essential book for us Messianic Jews to understand in so many different levels. There's so many different facets to the book of Hebrews. So it's a worthy investment for us to go into a bit more detail than we might ordinarily do in a message. This is probably going to take a few months to get through this book. And the way this will work is that I'll be teaching through Hebrews approximately twice a month, and then Rabbi Rich will be doing other messages, you know, along the lines of the Parsha and other topics. So we'll have some of each in terms of our different ways of looking at this. And then also we'll be recording these, and the idea is to be able to turn this Hebrews series down the road into, you know, a unit that we have on recording so that we can pass it on and use it for other things as well. Let's dive in with that. I'm really excited actually to jump into chapter one, but we're not going to jump into chapter one today because we need to do a lot of introduction in order to understand what Hebrews is about, to even understand chapter one. And so today I want to focus on background to the book of Hebrews. Why? If we don't know the context of a book, then it can dramatically impact how we read the book. And so before we jump into the temptation to just read the chapters, let's really get into and look at some of these questions about the context. Now, there are a few different ways to read the Bible. The traditional Jewish way is always to read the Bible through the lens of the sages. It's like we gather around with those who have come before us from thousands and thousands of generations all together, and we study the Bible through a community lens rather than through an individual lens. It's very, very important. Another way to read the Bible is more through the lens of modern scholarship. You know, we join with the modern experts, we join with the scholars, and we ask questions, who, what, when, where, how, why, you know, all these questions. We focus on the historical context of the biblical text, and we try to read it as close as possible to what the author intended his hearers to hear. That's what the modern scholarship world tries to do. It doesn't always succeed, but it tries to do that. And then thirdly, there's a more personalized spiritual way of reading the Bible. You know, when you personally feel that the Ruach is taking you into a passage and speaking to you specifically about it, even if, you know, the passage is written to someone else in a different time, in a different place. And God can really speak to us through that, can't he? You can open up the Bible at any place, and there can be a verse that's really to you that you kind of pull out of context, and that's a good thing. Now, I want to suggest that we need to be strong in all three of these different kinds of exegesis. What we're going to do during our study is touch on different ones and try to pull out different elements of the book of Hebrews from these different lenses that we have. And what happens is when we read the scripture along with the Jewish sages, we enter into conversations spanning these thousands of years. We connect with the Jewish people. It's really, really important. The insights from modern scholarship can often help us to avoid serious exegetical issues, which, as we'll see today, can cause some real problems, disastrous results. And, of course, we don't want to miss out on what God is speaking to us directly about the circumstances in our own lives. So let's just jump in. We're going to touch on all these things. Today I'm going to focus mostly on the historical scholarly approach, and we're going to try to answer the questions, what, whom, and why the book of Hebrews and what it's all about. Let's jump in. So what? First, we're going to start with, what is the book of Hebrews? What is it? The Bible contains a lot of different kinds of material. In your Bibles, you'll likely see it called the Letter to the Hebrews. The problem was that this traditional name, the Epistle to the Hebrews, was added on much later. It's actually not a part of the book. So it's someone else's interpretation that this is actually a letter. And this might be important. So let's look into the actual text. The reason it was traditionally called a letter has to do with the salutations at the end of the book. Know that our brother Timothy has been released. If he comes soon, I will come and visit with you. That's the author. Greet all your leaders in the Kedoshim, the holy ones. Those from Italy greet you. That's an important little salutation there about this book. However, the book itself doesn't read like a letter. It has no introductory remarks. It just jumps right in with this profound opening. And you open up Hebrews 1. In the past, God spoke to our ancestors through the prophets at many times and in various ways. Now, in the end of days, God has spoken to us by the Messiah, the Son of God, whom God appointed the heir of all things and through whom he made the universe. Bam! Right there. It's brilliant. It's really brilliant. But it's different than the Pauline epistles that we see, which begin with elegant introductions. Paul, an emissary of Messiah Yeshua by God's will to the Kedoshim and Ephesus, those trusting in Messiah Yeshua, grace and shalom to you from God our Father and Lord Yeshua the Messiah. That's Paul. That's how he begins his writings. Now, verse 13:22 actually identifies the work more as a word of exhortation. I urge you, brothers and sisters, listen patiently to this word of exhortation. So modern scholars today kind of reject the idea that this was actually a letter, and they suggest that this book was actually more of a drash. It was a sermon that might have been offered in a first century Messianic Jewish congregation of some kind, and then written down and then distributed, just like we might do with a recording. So they suggest that the salutations at the end may not have even been connected to the sermon. They may have been like a separate letter that the carrier carried with them, you know, that then got brought in and added into the end of the text, or at the very end added in so that it would be, you know, have something communicating to the people they were sending it to. Now, why does this matter? Hebrews offers a profound and urgent message for us, and I think it's helpful for us to see this as a kind of a drosh, as a word to encourage us. It's a message that transcends the Messianic Jews of the first century and relates to us. His encouragements, his insights, his warnings, they're all relevant for us today. So hold that. We're going to pull like a whole piece together here as we go through this. Now, when? When was Hebrews written? When was this distributed? Here's the thing. We don't really know any of these things. It doesn't say like in the year of, you know, this thing happened. But we can narrow down a window of time, and I think pretty accurately. The latest date possible for Hebrews to have been written is probably around 96 would be the latest possible date. And that's because we see excerpts of Hebrews written in Clement of Rome's first epistle to the Corinthians. And so if he's quoting it here, then we know that it was in wide circulation probably long before that. Does that make sense? Now, evidence coming from within the book itself helps us to date that much earlier. And scholars have different opinions on this. I can't get into all the different opinions because of time. The best opinion in my mind, the one that wins out above all, is that references to the temple service throughout here and the offerings and the sacrifice in the Greek are all in present tense. So the priests serve and they offer sacrifices in an ongoing way. Now the temple was destroyed in 70. So if the priests are still serving, then we know that it must have been written before that in this context. Also, the temple is such a central theme of the whole book. If it was written after the destruction, why would you not put that in your book? You know, why would that not be a part of the letter that we have here? Why would it not be mentioned? And then there's other internal evidence to suggest, even earlier, there's no reference to political issues that are happening with Rome as we lead up in the late 60s into 70s. And I think we could argue that the latest window is late 50s, early 60s of the Common Era, you know, somewhere between Acts 2 and, you know, this experience here. Now, we're going to see why this becomes important in a few moments, why this context of the dating of this becomes very important for how we understand the book. Okay, number three, who wrote the book of Hebrews? This one we really have no idea. We really don't know. But we can find some things out about who the author might have been or what kind of person he was, and I think that's really important. There are some traditions. There's a second century tradition that the letter was a lost letter of Paul. That was like the most prominent church tradition. Today, I would say probably, I'm making up a number, but 98% of scholars think that it was not written by Paul, modern scholarship. That doesn't mean they're right, but that's you know, just kind of where it is. Why? There are a number of Pauline concepts in the book. Well, this is the reason why you would think it would be. There are a number of Pauline concepts that are in the book that you can compare with other letters. The salutations at the end reference Timothy. Timothy was Paul's protege. And so this is where some of these things come from. We can see that people would have wanted it to be Paul, because this book wasn't brought into the scripture until the 4th century. And so you could see why people would want it to be Paul, because that would give it authority. So there's a motivation there. But the reason scholars don't believe that it was Paul is because in Paul's letters, he usually identifies himself in the beginning and then talks about himself multiple times throughout the book. I, Paul, I say this. I write with my own hand. This is me speaking, not the Ruach HaKodesh speaking. He has this whole narrative that he doesn't include in Hebrews, or it isn't included. Also, the Greek in Hebrews is sophisticated, like the most sophisticated Greek in the entire Brit Hadashah. And so it's not Pauline Greek. It's a Greek that's of a higher educational level than Paul, who Greek, you know, may have been his second language, at least. Not that he was not sophisticated, I don't mean that, but it's like a different style of Greek. Paul's voice is most often in the first person. Hebrews is often in the plural. Another difference here that we have. And then also, give or take, Paul considered himself an apostle to the Gentiles. And he wrote most of his letters to the Gentiles, Rome, a mixed community. Not impossible that he would write to, the Messianic Jewish community, but maybe more unlikely. Okay, what we do know about the author was that the author was highly educated, fluent in upper-class Greek language and theoretical, philosophical concepts because of what's in the book. We also know that he was very familiar with Judaism and able to use rabbinic-style arguments that became part of the ways that the rabbis communicated years later. We know that he had a lot of apostolic authority, and if it wasn't Paul, it was clearly written by someone who knew Paul. I think that's important. Now, Origen, a writer of the second century, said this of Hebrews. If I were to state my own opinion, I should say that the thoughts are the apostles, but that the style and composition belong to one who called to mind the apostles' teaching and, as it were, made short notes of what his master said. This is a second century text writing about Hebrews. I think that's interesting. Other traditions actually suggest Luke. Some suggest Barnabas. Some suggest Priscilla. Yeah, in the book of Acts. That would be interesting. But there's no evidence one way or the other. They're just guesses. Eusebius in the 4th century cites a tradition that Clement of Rome was actually the author. And this is an interesting one. It makes a little bit of sense given the salutation. Those in Italy send their greetings. So someone may have written this from Rome. And Clement is actually referenced in Paul's letter, we think, in Philippians 4:3. He was a highly educated Roman who, according to tradition, became a close disciple of Peter. He knew Paul, he knew Barnabas. After Peter and Paul were martyred in Rome, Clement became the leader of the Yeshua follower community in Rome. He wrote a letter to Corinthians that's very similar to Paul's letter to Corinthians. It has similar themes that's in the book of Hebrews. It's not part of our Bible. And the tradition has it that about the year 100, he was martyred by being cast off of a ship tied to the anchor. Now, whoever the author was, we know that they were, again, very educated, position of authority, knew the first generation of apostles intimately, likely a second generation disciple, likely writing from Rome with apostolic authority, who knew the followers of Messiah from around the whole region. So, an important guy. Okay, whom was it written to? Now we're honing in to more and more, things that are going to really give us some material to work with. Now, we need to consider who the hearers were in order to establish the context of the letter, what's actually going on. Now, based on the bulk of the content in the book, it seems to be addressing early Messianic Jewish believers in Yeshua in Jerusalem. The author assumes that his readers are very literate in Hebrew Bible, citing scriptures all over the place without explaining them. He assumes that they're very familiar with midrashic and rabbinic style arguments of the first century. He uses them all the time. At the same time, these readers also had to speak Greek. And that was commonplace. We wondered, did that happen? Were there Messianic Jews in Jerusalem who were fluent in sophisticated Greek? Do you remember in Acts 6:9, the synagogue of the freedmen? They were Hellenized Jews in Jerusalem who were instrumental in persecuting Stephan. And they regularly participated in the temple. So we know that there were Hellenized Jews who were in the upper class in Jerusalem who participated in temple worship, and I would imagine that likely a lot of those, and priests and different people, became Yeshua followers and were part of the Jerusalem community. Some argue that the original recipients would have had to be in Jerusalem because the author makes references to eating sacred foods from the temple that only those who regularly participated in the temple service would have known about and would have understood what was actually going on. So, let's assume that this was written to early Messianic Jewish community in Jerusalem before the destruction of the temple, before Roman persecution became rampant in Jerusalem. Late 50s, early 60s. Okay, that leads us to our last question, which is, why was it written to them? And this is the answer to discover the interpret the message. Now, I've mentioned that there was a traditional reading of Hebrews, which the traditional reading, what it does is it reads later anti-Jewish and anti-Torah ideas back into the book of Hebrews. And this is why our understanding the context is so important, because beginning of the late 3rd, 4th century, the traditional reading of Hebrews is very dangerous. And the traditional reading of Hebrews that went all the way through the Protestant Reformation into the modern era was reading anti-Jewish ideas that were in the community at that time back into this book. And we're going to show why that doesn't make sense. Let me share with you what the tradition is. This is the traditional reading in Catholic and Protestant circles. And really, this is the one that you get today. If you read the NIV commentary, you read, different ones, this is basically the thrust of it. And then its interpretations and its applications vary widely. One, the traditional reading of Hebrews says that the Torah and the sacrificial system were only valuable in so much as they pointed to Yeshua. They represented the old ways. Yeshua is the new ways. They represent the old ways of the flesh, in Pauline language, in his other letters. Does that make sense? Okay. Two, Yeshua's sacrifice canceled the temple sacrifice, and the Torah became a useless relic of the past. They get this from Hebrews. It was once described in a modern way to me, in a message that I heard, of like the old bulky cell phone with the, the thing, the wire. I do remember that, by the way. Versus like the new iPhone, Like, Yeshua is the new way, this is the old way. This is taught. This is a very common way to teach this. And they pull it out of the language in Hebrews, the new and old language and things like that. Now, three, with this lens, the book of Hebrews is a book urging Jewish followers of Yeshua not to backslide into the old, outdated temple system or not to go back under Moses and Torah. So taken to its logical end, the book of Hebrews tells Jews not to be Jews. And that's the traditional reading. Now, regrettably, this interpretation fueled later anti-Jewish politics and sentiments. You guys know the history, beginning in Constantine in the 4th century, continuing through the Protestant era, and even into today to some degree. The early church politicians and even theologians, if you read the history, often debated whether or not to kill Jews because of these concepts. Now, this is taking the reading to an extreme, of course, but whenever you have an idea, whenever you have a theology, you need to say, what is the extreme of this theology? Because people will take it to its extreme. Other voices, like Augustine, famous Augustine, he saw that without the Jewish people, the church makes no sense. And he came to our defense, arguing that we should live, we shouldn't be killed. I mean, he actually said, no, the Jews should live, but we should be made to live so miserably that we can bear witness to a people rejected by God. Quote, unquote, from Augustine. Other Christian leaders were less harsh. We need to have some balance, too. There were some that really treated the Jews well. But virtually all who were recorded in those times felt that Hebrews made being Jewish obsolete in Yeshua. It's pretty much across the board until modern scholars are starting to change, and we're starting to change our understanding here. Now, the danger of replacement theology, that I'm speaking replacement theology, and the danger of reading books out of their historical context is the history. You can see this. And here's where our work on the context becomes so important. The traditional reading doesn't make sense according to the context of the book. Why? Think of what was going on in the late 50s and early 60s. The entire book of Acts is happening during that time. Where did the first Messianic Jews go to gather? They didn't have churches. Christianity didn't exist yet. when you read in the Christian translations, you read church, it actually, the Greek word is ekklesia, which means assembly, the gathering place. So whenever it says, you know, the church, it's the gathering place. You know, and sometimes ekklesia is used to refer to the synagogue where Jews would gather. See? So where did they gather? Luke tells us the disciples gathered and met in Jerusalem regularly in the temple, continually praising God. They met in the temple. Acts 5:12, they were all in Solomon's, together in Solomon's portico in one place. Solomon's portico on the eastern side of the temple's outer court. It says that they met there daily. So they had a place where they liked to meet, you know, in the temple, a beautiful area, and that was the Messianic Jewish quarter. That's where they gathered. Early Messianic Jews were a temple sect. Other communities planted further away emulated their mother community in Jerusalem. The temple was the geographical and theological center of their faith. Why? Because Yeshua revered the temple. Remember when he was 12 years old and he disappeared from his parents, and where did they find him? In the temple, what does he say? I'm in my Father's house, right? He didn't say, this is obsolete, I don't need to be here. I'm in my Father's house. Zeal consumed him when he saw the corruption in the temple. Why? Because he loved the temple. He prophesied its destruction, yes, but with sorrow. He says, in the temple, you won't see me again until you say, Baruch haba b'shem Adonai, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Where is he going to come back to? The temple area. The tradition is Mount of Olives, right there. Now, first century Jewish believers were all about being in the temple. I think it's really important. You have to read that into the book of Hebrews. Daniel Lancaster at Beth Emmanuel Congregation did a series on Hebrews back in 2012 that I've been listening in on too, and he has some interesting insights. One in Acts 2 that I thought was really interesting, he suggests that the reason the early Messianic Jews sold all their possessions and gathered together in one place wasn't because that was like the best way to do it, but it was because Jerusalem and the temple was becoming the central meeting place, and Messianic Jews and even Gentiles from the nations were coming in, and they were so excited, they wanted to be at the place of action. They wanted to be with the original disciples. They wanted to worship in the temple with everyone else. And so they would leave their places and travel and come around into the center, and the community didn't have any way to take care of all of these people. So they had to come up with communal kinds of living and sell your possessions and let's gather and let's take care of each other because people are on the streets. You know, we don't have enough homes to fill. You know, it was a circumstance, something that was happening at that time. It's a really interesting way of looking at that passage. They wanted to be near the action in the temple. Further, in the end of Acts, Paul goes to Jerusalem and offers sacrifices publicly in the temple. This is some 30 years later. This is probably after Hebrews was written. He goes and publicly offers sacrifices in the temple, specifically to prove to the other Messianic Jews in the area that he was still an observant Jew. This is Acts chapter 21. The idea that Yeshua's sacrifice canceled the temple sacrifices didn't exist when the book of Hebrews was written. The key eyewitness disciples didn't know about it. That can't be what Hebrews is about. Now, as the Messianic Jewish community grew larger and larger, they drew more and more attention. We read in Acts that they were told to stop speaking about Yeshua in the temple. They were arrested. Do you remember this? The angel sets them free and says, go back and start speaking again in the temple. And it says in Acts 5:42 that they remained in the temple speaking about him every day. They continued to meet, even with the persecution. Stephan was stoned on false accounts of speaking against the temple. And Acts makes it clear that they were false. They were lies. He wasn't speaking against the temple. But the Sadducean priesthood that was Hellenized, that was informed by Rome, wanted them out. For whatever their reasons were, they wanted them out. And so they had him stoned. Yaakov, or James, as his name was changed to James later on, he was the head of the Jerusalem community at this time. And it says, according to the tradition about him, that he would remain in the temple and pray all day so that his knees were sore all the time. And the wider Jewish community revered James and called him Yaakov the Tzaddik. He was the righteous one. But there were some political shifts that happened, according to the story. The Sadducean leadership, they came in and they did like a little illegal court. They took James, they brought him up to the top of the temple wall, and they said, if you don't renounce Yeshua, we'll push you off. He didn't renounce Yeshua, they pushed him off. but he didn't die. So they stoned him, but he didn't die. So they took a club and whacked him, and then he died. That's our leader in Jerusalem. Now, what if the author of Hebrews never intended his letter to undermine the temple or the Torah, but instead he was encouraging them to press on after they lost their leader, Yaakov? To press on when they were being forced out of their beloved meeting place in the temple because of their faith in Yeshua. What if our Messianic Jewish brothers and sisters were wavering, giving up on Yeshua faith in order to be allowed back into the temple worship, their focal point of their faith? Can you imagine? We like to idealize the first century, but it wasn't like that, you know? Their friends, their neighbors are part of the temple experience. These are priests. Come on, just get rid of that stuff and just come back in. You don't need to, you know, you don't need to stand out like that, you know? We'd be tempted too. The author of Hebrews wrote an urgent exhortation in verse 10:23. Let us hold fast to our confession and our hope without wavering. Stay firm to Yeshua in the wake of the pressures, because as important and as good as the temple is, Yeshua is the focal point of our faith, because Yeshua is the focal point of the temple. It doesn't diminish the temple. It lifts the temple up. And this is not a question just for the first century. Many Jews struggle with these similar issues. Judaism is so great, why do we need Yeshua? You know, like, okay. Or Yeshua is so great, why do we need Judaism? Kind of the flip side to that question. We're stuck between worlds. You know, why bother? You know, why bother? I was trying to explain how we Messianic Jews feel that we're marginalized within the wider Jewish community. I was talking with the Orthodox professor that is teaching the Mea class that I'm taking through Hebrew College. And we were just having this really good conversation after the class. And he said, you know, you're the one choosing to be marginalized in the Jewish community. You don't have to be a follower of Yeshua. You could just be a regular Jew. He wasn't trying to deceive me. He was just, you could just be regular, or just choose to be a Christian. You know, you're the one putting yourself in this marginalized place, right? And I said, for me, Yeshua is the heart of everything Jewish. There really is no Judaism without him. And of course, we can't separate him from Judaism because that is who Yeshua is. See, the author of Hebrews answers these questions through brilliant rabbinic-style arguments and demonstrates how it is that Yeshua is literally the heartbeat of the Jewish faith. That's Hebrews. He uses the kol v'chomer arguments, the idea of kol v'chomer is how much more so? He uses this argument again and again and again. If angels are great, how much more so is Yeshua, who is the manifestation of God himself? You know, if Torah and Moses are essential, Moses wrote about Yeshua. If the consequence of not following Torah was death in the wilderness for our ancestors, how much worse is the consequence of rejecting the one the Torah spoke about? The sacrificial system cleanses so we can approach the inner rooms of the temple. How much more so does Yeshua's sacrifice in the heavenly realm enable us to enter the kingdom of God? And see, these arguments for Yeshua's supreme importance within Judaism rests on the high value for and the assumed authority of Moses. So according to Hebrews, Yeshua's centrality actually validates Torah and Judaism rather than cancels it. And so now we're in this amazing position, because you and I are literally among the first to have the obligation and the privilege to reclaim this book, the book of Messianic Jews, to learn the important lessons that it has for us, to live them out in our small but important Messianic Jewish congregation, Ruach Israel. So as we go through this study over the coming months, we're going to get into this, and we're going to flesh it out, and we're going to try our best to live it out as a community. Shabbat Shalom. Please, O Lord, our God, let the words of your Torah sweet in our mouths. Please, O Lord, our God, let the words of your Torah sweet in our mouths, in the mouths of your people.
people in the mouths of the house of Israel, and may your descendants and the descendants of your people.